Thank you very much for the invitation. And I'm just going to talk about the basics of forming giant planets in a disk. So the general idea is you have a young star. There's a disk around it extending out to 40 AU or so away from the star. The disk has a composition of material that's similar to that of the sun, and which is mostly hydrogen and helium. And the important component, however, is the 1%, which is the heavier elements that are heavier than hydrogen and helium. And 1% of the heavy elements are roughly are condensed into grains into very small solid particles in this disk at the time of the formation of the disk. So we want to figure out from this initial state, how do you form a giant planet? We want to be able to understand both the planets in the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, nearest Neptune, and the 100 or so extrasolar planets that have been discovered up to this date.
The stuff that the star was made out of, what's left over from the formation of the star?
The disk is a part of the formation, is left over from the formation process of the star. And during the formation of the star, actually, the disk tends to accrete material onto the star and build up the star's mass. But the disk can start off maybe with 20-25% of the mass of the star, and it gradually decreases with time until, at the end, the disk disappears after, say, 3 or 4 million years, and you have a star without a disk. Or maybe a very, very low mass, difficult to observe remnant disk.
Can I ask a related question? Are binary star systems formed in the same way where the disk collects the beam? That is, are these giant planets?
Well, this is part of the Angular-Mentum problem of star formation. The cloud from which the initial collapse of an interstellar cloud occurs, that cloud has a fair amount of Angular-Mentum. And when it collapses, some of that angular momentum, the spin of that initial cloud, may end up in the binary orbit of a binary system that's formed by fragmentation early on in the collapse. And so, but even those fragments, each of those may still have quite a bit of angular momentum, each of the two binary fragments. So they may condense to form stars, but there's still plenty of angular momentum left in those condensations, so that part of that may end up in the disk. So what you could have is two components, the binary star, and each one of them has a disk.
Nice.
Yeah, so yes, you could have a disk in a binary system as well.
But it's not the case that every binary star, one star formed first and the other one formed later.
Oh, that's a possibility, but the general theory for forming binary systems seems to be that they've both formed together pretty close at the same time. Yeah.
What's the size of the disk? I mean, is there some length?
Well, that's really determined by the angular momentum of the initial cloud. And so there's the rotation rates of this initial
cloud. The
initial cloud has a size of, well, say, 0.1 parsecs, and that's 10 to the 17 centimeters. and it has a certain rotation rate. So then you can figure out what, if that cloud just collapsed in free fall and conserved angular momentum. What would be the size of the what would be the centrifugal barrier basically for the outermost material? And that turns out to be, well, say 100, 200 astronomical units. There's going to be a spread depending on the cloud you look at. And that says the typical disk size is going to be a few hundred astronomical units. That's, we were interested here in probably the inner 10 or 20. Those astronomical units. The outer parts are probably too low density to form planets. But that sets the scales, the angular momentum of these initial clouds. And that's been measured. And the disks have been observed around the young stars, and their size is determined. And they're typically 100 of AU, 1,000 AU in that range. Okay, so the idea is, how do you form the giant planet? I'm going to start off with three problems. So the idea is you're going to form a you start off with a, this. You're going to start off with the solid material. There's 1% of material that's in dust particles, let's say. And build up by collisions between those particles, you're going to have to build up the core of the giant planet, which is going to be the solid material. And the problem number one is timescales that people have recently calculated for building up those cores are long, varied width, the lifetimes of the disks. Okay. All right, so that's compared to the disk lifetime, 3 million years, say.
Lifetime to do what?
Okay, let's call that the half-life of a disk. And after that time, if you look at the young stars observationally and try to figure out whether your disk is still there or not, by looking at the infrared radiation, half the disks are gone. Half the young stars don't have disks anymore after 3 million years.
The assumption is that they form planets from those disks? Or
we don't know. Either it accretes onto the star, or the stellar wind, or the UV from the star, or the radiation from the star blows it away. And it's going to be some combination of those effects that get rid of the disk. And that's mainly based on near-infrared observations, and that there is some uncertainty in how long this actually lasts. But of course, you need to build the core before the disk goes away, because you have to have the gas there to then accrete onto the planet.
So that
means giant. Yes.
You can identify the life of the star that well? I mean, the age of the star that well?
That's a good question. You can determine the age of a star. That well depends, is depending on how good accuracy you want. And to within maybe a million years, it's uncertain, so this number has an error bar on it. but it is pretty clear once a star gets up to, say, 10 to the 7th years old, beyond that point, the age dating is pretty good. And beyond that time, we also know that there are practically no disks around them. So somewhere between 3 million and 10 million, they go away. So you've got to have the gas there to make the giant planets, so that's your constraint. The second problem is going to be migration. So even if the planet does form, even if the planet does form a disk, starts to build up the core and grows to a certain size, it'll interact gravitationally with a disk, which will induce a torque on it. The torque will tend to send the planet inwards. In some cases, people are still working on this problem as well. In some cases, it may go outwards, but the general trend seems to be the planet goes inwards. And the time scale of the migration can be shorter than the formation time of the planet, so it doesn't grow to become a giant planet.
Observation,
but the migration?
Right.
Well, it's partly simulation. There have been a lot of simulations, and it's partly based on observations. And I'll show you the observation, sketch the observation in a second. And the third problem is, because of this long time scale to build up the cores, it has been suggested that maybe you need something to speed things up. And one of the ideas floating around at the moment is that you could have vortices forming in the disk by hydrodynamic, thermodynamic processes. And the big question is, do you form vortices . And if you do form vortices, can that accelerate the formation time of a planet? So those are the three problems. And the main point of this talk is to avoid these three problems in as much as is possible. Okay, now I'm going to just mention.
Long core formation times, that's the core of the planet?
Yes, you think of a planet for this purpose as a solid core of rock, say. And ice, and a gaseous envelope of hydrogen and helium with a little bit of heavy elements mixed in.
So when you model that, it takes too long.
So when you, even the, just to get the core. And then there's another problem getting the gas onto the core. So that could take a long time also. But I say this is, but this problem is, I think, more important than that problem. And that the formation time for the core, I think, is the, at the moment, is a problem that hasn't been solved, while the gas accretion problem may have been solved. Okay, so now, the range of physical conditions is quite large. The initial disk, say, it can be very cold, say 10, 20 degrees Kelvin. The inside of a planet, once it forms, a giant planet, can be up to 40,000 degrees. The range of densities is very large. The density in the low, you have a low density disk, especially in the outer parts, maybe 10 to the minus 11th grams per cubic centimeter. And the interior of a planet, once it does form in the core, you're getting up to 10, 20 grams per cubic centimeter. So there's many orders of magnitude range. The big range is from the mass of a dust particle, which is pretty small, up to an Earth. The dust particle mass is something like 10 to the minus 14 grams. And that's the building block you start from. The Earth is 10 to the 28 grams. So you've got 10 to the 42 orders of magnitude to go in building up this core. And you need to get it up to an order of Earth mass or bigger. And that's where that's the major problem. And there's a lot of physics involved of various kinds. MHD, thermodynamics, magnetic fields, convection, radiation transport, collisions of particles, material strength. There's just quite a large range. Chemistry in the disk, formation of molecules, and so on. Grain physics, it's all pretty complicated. It could well be that there's some piece of physics in that chain of processes that isn't understood yet. We don't know about it yet.
What's magnetic field important?
It turns out in the inner parts of disks, you can have a little bit of ionization from the heating by the star. And in the outer parts of disks, you can have ionization by cosmic rays.
But I thought mostly it's the grains falling into each other and did not.
It's mostly collisional, but one of the important elements of this whole problem is the evolution of the disk itself. And if there's a magnetic field tied to the matter, there's a so-called magnetorotational instability that can generate turbulence, cause the accretion of the disk on the material on the star. Okay, for the planet formation process itself, apart from the disk, I think it's less important. Okay, so there's a big range, and maybe some physics that isn't too well understood. Now, what do we have to explain? This would help in generating the right theory. First basic fact we have to explain is the distribution of the extrasolar planets. Draw a diagram and call this mass. It's actually M sine I, but it's pretty close to the actual mass of the 100 or so extrasolar planets, and they range from 0.1 to 10 Jupiter masses so far observed now. Then on this scale, I'm going to put the semi-major axis. And that goes from, say, 0.1. That's the astronomical units. Say 1, 0.1, 1, up to 10. And most of the observed planets, well, the closest one to the star is in there somewhere, very close to the star, 0.02 AU. But most of them are sort of scattered out to. So they're scattered all over the place, 10 Jupiter masses down to about 0.1. 0.1 Jupiter masses. And the semi-major axis go from very close to the star, and there's sort of a pile-up in here at 0.03 AU. But I'm not going to talk about the details, just the general picture. Out to 5 AU, say. have been observed. And they haven't been observed beyond 5 AU just because it's an observational cutoff. People haven't been looking long enough to get those long, the long periods. Okay.
But, I'm asking, where would Jupiter be on this time?
Okay, Jupiter is massive. massive one.
Horizontal.
It's a massive one and a 5 AU, so. So Jupiter's right there. Okay, the problem with is that the typical core accretion model, gas capture model, will make your planet so about there. Say between 5 and 10 AU. This is the preferred location in the disk where you can make planets by this process. It's very hard to make them in this range of distances. It's really hard. And that's the observational evidence. And then your question about migration. And if the model is really correct and they form way out here, that could maybe be a little closer than that. But that's the general idea of fairly high mass in the model and fairly large distance. In order to explain the ones that are in here, which is almost all of them discovered so far, it looks like you had to have migration.
Fortunately for us, Jupiter didn't migrate into Earth's orbit.
Fortunately, that's very, yes, that's very fortunate.
Well, you say modeling yes. predicts at one point, presumably depending on the parameter range, this whole block in this plot.
For this, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's just a typical point. It's a typical point.
It's a typical
point. But say between,
the
say, but, as I would say, theoretical models say it's very hard to make one inside 1 AU. There's a small chance you could make one, say, at 2 AU, but the best place, 5 to 10 AU. And if once you get out farther, it gets worse.
But observations that you make for those things, what did you say?
These are observed.
Yeah, but did you say that?
No. Nothing has been observed yet beyond, say,
but
5.
It's
not because you're not there.
Because you have
to get, if you to get a full orbit, you got to wait 10, 15 years. So the data is still coming in. So they will be. But they just aren't there yet.
Should we trust the models? I mean, is that?
I would say, as far as core accretion gas capture, there've been enough studies, detailed studies made so far to say that inside 1 AU is really going to be hard. Build a planet there. Yes.
So Johannes is saying that there may be a data bias that in near the theoretical point there could be a lot.
There could be.
There could be.
I'm just saying that's where you're going to make the models. I'm not saying there aren't any planets there, but still.
Well, being
Yeah.
Supposed to be provocative and entertaining for the particle physicists, you know, want to get into the sociology a little bit here. I mean, people should realize that, you know, there's been many, many decades, in fact, centuries of work on planet formation.
Yes.
And throughout all this time, there was only one planetary system. And so not too surprisingly, the theory for how to form Jupiter happens to form Jupiter just where Jupiter is in the solar system. So what's happened, now there are these hundreds of Jupiters that are all over the place. And instead of going back to scratch and asking if there isn't another theory, people still cling to the old theory, which forms Jupiter at 5 AU, that they want to add an extra layer of theory that will bring it then later on from 5 AU to...
That's the current, that's the idea.
I want to keep that in mind.
Well, I mean, that's not very good, right? Because it was actually predicted that planets should migrate before before they were found there. It just was ignored. So it's not like an extra ad hoc layer was added. This was already known to be an issue, but people had ignored it because it didn't match the observation.
That's right. That's right. And I think the big question that has been talked about quite a bit is why Jupiter didn't migrate, or maybe it did migrate a little bit. Maybe it came out, maybe it was formed a little bit farther out and migrated in, but I don't think it could have formed that much farther out. So if it migrated, it probably didn't migrate very much.
Is the problem with forming in close, it's too hot there?
One, the ice evaporates at, say, 3 AU, inward of 3 AU, and instead of the full 1% of condensed material, you have this, there's less than that. It's only down to 0.3%.
Thanks.
And that's one of a number of reasons. the turns out that it's so, maybe I get to this later, but the so-called isolation mass, the maximum mass of planet can grow to before it uses up all the solid material in its vicinity, is increases outwards. And in the inner part of the solar system, it's much less than the Earth mass. So that's another reason. And that's very hard to get around. But I won't go into it. There's a special case maybe where you can make a planet close to the star, but it's sort of unlikely. All right, so this has to be explained. That's point number one. Point number two is that there is a correlation with metallicity of the star. So let's just call this the heavy elements in the star, which has a planet around it, and divided by this solar heavy elements, which is about 2% by mass, measured in the sun. And this is, in this axis, we plot the percent of those stars that have planets observed.
The
stars you're looking at are all the stars are nearby stars. They're all solar type. They all have certain observational characteristics which lead them to be put on the list to be observed. That they're favorable for looking for planets. So in that sense, there are biases. But this sample is unbiased in the sense that all of the stars in this this diagram, I haven't plotted yet, have been observed long enough, say three years or so. So it has been determined that they either have a planet or they don't have a planet. Okay, and so he said, call one, call that solar, and call this 3 and 10. Actually, go up to 10. 0.3 and 0.1. And so the percentage of the stars of the planets, 20%, 10%. And out here, it's practically zero between 0.1 and 0.3. And it goes up a little bit. Say, in order of, yeah, it's okay. Say, 5. Like that. And it isn't exact, but that's the trend. This is percentage of stars with planets as a function of metallicity, and this simply means that the metallicity of the star is only 0.1 of that of the sun, and there are plenty of those available to be observed. It turns out that this sample isn't as good as the sample, and it hasn't been ruled out here that there are no planets around low metallicity stars. But so far, they haven't found any in this range, zero.
Are low metallicity stars very young, or, what is the correlate of?
Well, low metallicity stars tend to be older stars.
Older.
The very, very lowest metallicity stars were probably formed very early in the history of the universe, when the metals hadn't been made yet.
But and isn't there an extreme bias? Well, not an extreme bias. It's much harder to observe planets around stars that have lower metallicity.
It's not that much harder.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's true that they've been none in this range, I believe, and the percentage rapidly increases. So whatever theory you have, the trend is clear. The high metallicity, three times solar, is considered high metallicity. And at that level, it's like 20% of the stars have planets.
The metallicity of the star is not
a... This is of the star, compared to the sun.
Can you measure metallicity of the disk as well?
Metallicity of the disk itself? Well, it's always presumed to be the same as that of the star. Same as that, since the disk essentially made the star, it's going to have a very similar composition. Well, a large fraction of the material that formed the star went through the disk on the way. Okay, so that's the second thing. It's a very strong trend.
You run out of stars on the right?
Yes. Yes, I mean, 10 times solar, I think, is extremely rare for metallicities.
So what is the percentage for solar metallicities?
That's 5% or something like that, like 5%.
About 10%.
Hmm? Right.
For 3 times solar, it's about 20%.
Yeah. So anyway.
But that's to have a big planet pretty near the star, right? Because otherwise you can't see the planet.
But in order, I mean, the technique for observing the planets is to look at the radial velocity of the star.
Right.
And you get the back reaction of the
so
stellar.
So a little planet far away doesn't make the star move, and therefore we don't know that it's there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so it's much easier to find a big planet near the star, but the technique is sensitive enough so it clearly can find planets out to 5 AU and probably farther out if it's massive enough.
This sample, yes. to answer your question, this sample is only addressing Jupiter mass, Hyper, and with a period less than 5 years or something.
Yeah, I think these are all less than 3 years or so.
Less than 3 years. So,
those can be fine. I mean, the sensitivity is what 10 meters per second or better for the velocity of accuracy, and so that translates into being able to find Jupiter at 5 AU, for example, no problem. Just have to observe long enough. Yeah.
It may also be worth mentioning in the context of this correlation is that the correlation is stronger for the shorter period planets, which presumably migrated more, whereas it's weaker for the more distant planets.
Okay, well, it's probably a bit, that's maybe a bit controversial. Suppose if you just make a plot, which I'm not going to do, but make a plot of the period of the planet.
I was going to ask a question. Is the data good enough to actually show this step structure?
That's just the way it's been.
It's crummy data.
That's just the way it's been. It's been. the total number. Wait.
There's only about 100 extrasolar planets now.
But there are 100 extrasolar planets right there.
So those
are just the bins. That's arbitrary. But the total number of stars observed in the sample is about 750. So it's a reasonable amount of data. And back to his question, if you plot the period versus the metallicity of a star, which I've looked at, there's no correlation at all. It may be a very slight effect at the short periods of having high metallicity. It is very small.
Right, if you look at the fraction of stars which have planets as a function of both metallicity and orbital period.
It's a little bit higher for the close-in planets. Okay. Well, anyway, that's what you got to explain. then the third point and final point is the giant planets in the solar system. I'll just make a very small table. Heavy elements in the giant in Jupiter and Saturn. So I'm just going to plot, write down. Jupiter and Saturn, okay. So this is the amount of heavy elements in Earth masses we think is in these planets. In the case of the core of Jupiter, this is the very inner bit of it. It's about 5. In the case of Saturn, it's about 10. And there's a big error bar on these numbers, and I'm not going to go into the details of that. These are sort of representative current numbers. And the total heavy elements, the core plus the heavy elements that we know to exist in the outer envelope mixed in with the gas, it's about 25. And 25 for Jupiter and Saturn. And so, and we just put down here the metals divided by the solar. So the heavy element content of the planet as a whole compared to that of the Sun and Jupiter is enhanced by a factor of 4 to 5 over the age of the sun, and Saturn is enhanced by a factor of 12 or so. Okay, metals over solar. four to five. Okay, I put it over there. Yes.
Very nice. What do you mean by heavy elements and metals? Everything about helium.
Everything about helium.
Now, one often reads in more popular accounts that Jupiter just missed being a star. Can I see this from this table?
No, Jupiter is...
In what sense is it? It's almost a star.
But Jupiter is 300 or so Earth masses.
So if it's a little bit heavier, you would tell
me. No, not really.
No?
Not really.
18
times. You need 0.08 of a solar mass, which is 80 Jupiters, in order to get hydrogen burning. Let's define a star that something that burns hydrogen. Okay. Nuclear reactions. Jupiter's way is pretty far away from that possibility. Okay, so we need to explain this enhancement. Mm-hmm. The first problem I mentioned at the beginning, maybe the long formation time of the core compared to the disk lifetime. There's been an alternative to the core accretion process suggested, namely that the disk could, under certain conditions, undergo a gravitational instability. It just forms little gravitationally bound subcondensations within the disk. On a very short time scale, and thereby get around this time scale problem. However, there are numerous problems with that picture. You need a relatively massive disk. There are other problems that I'm not going to go into at the moment. However, there have been a lot of computer simulations recently done on making giant planets in a disk by gravitational instability, and they've generated lots of nice graphics. And a lot of publicity. This is actually the Pittsburgh Supercomputer Center magazine. And they're saying how to cook a giant planet by gravitational instability. And so I'm just going to pass this around. And it's probably wrong. Maybe pretty pictures, but probably wrong. Under some special conditions, it could happen.
Do these people actually know that it's probably wrong?
And they've heard the arguments. They've heard the arguments. Yeah. Okay. So, I'm not going to say any more about that model at the moment because Sandy Woods on Stardate said that giant planets are formed by a core accretion gas capture. So I'm going to say a little more about that. I'm going to talk about that. So we've got to explain the 3 million lifetime of the disk. We've got to explain the heavy elements of Jupiter and Saturn. We have to explain the distribution and mass and period of the extrasolar planets, along with some other properties of those planets, which I won't go into right now. So. To make the problem a little simpler, let's start off with the point where you have your disk, and there has been sufficient collisional evolution to build up these tiny little particles to a size of maybe a kilometer or so, at least some of them are up to a kilometer size. And the question is, how do you go from kilometer size so-called planetesimals, rocks, up to Jupiters? So just to consider that part of the problem for the moment. And so there are going to be a couple of phases, or a few phases. 1 kilometer of planetesimals will still undergo collisions and gravitational interactions.
How dense are these planetesimals? What's the
density pressure? Density of, typical planetesimal, you can think of like a comet, a nucleus, ice, and a little bit of rock. Okay. So density 1 or 2. Okay. The grams per cubic centimeter.
Yep.
So that's typical. So the first phase, we get that up to about an Earth mass just by collisions then you can start collecting the gravitational effects of the core. You can start collecting a little bit of a gas around it. Get a low mass gaseous envelope around the core. So the core will be the solid part. The envelope is, I'm going to call the gaseous part, although it's going to have some solids in it. It's sprinkled through it as well. That's the second stage. You start collecting a little bit of gas, but not very much compared to the core. Then, as the gas mass increases, it gradually, and this takes, it's rather a slow process, eventually the gas mass increases faster than the core mass. And you get to the point where the two are the same. I'm going to call that the crossover point. Which is M core equals M envelope. And once the gas mass is comparable to that of the core, then there's a very rapid accretion phase. There's essentially unstable rapid accretion of gas. Building up to, say, Jupiter mass. And at some point, the final stage is, I'll just call this termination. Where the gas accretion stops by processes probably associated with the opening up of a gap by the tidal effects of the planet in the disk, pushing material away, actually getting to the point where there's no mass left to accrete. All right, so the core accretion theory predicts if you go through some detailed calculation, that does predict ten to 15 Earth mass cores. It does predict a trend with metallicity. There's a higher fraction with increasing metallicity. And the problem is, why does it take so long? Okay, so let's say a word about why it takes so long.
Just a quick word on the actual calculations. I mean, numerics, analytic things with scaling arguments.
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Let's go into, first of all, calculating the time evolution of the particles built up to the core. And then one has to take into account the gases on top of the core. And then one needs a model which includes hydrostatic equilibrium, the radiation that's coming off the top of the planet, the heating sources of the planet, which could be contraction, which could be planetesimals falling through the envelope, landing on the core and releasing gravitational energy, and including energy transport, radiation or convection. So it's a reasonably detailed model. Even in 1D, it's a reasonably detailed model. So the planetesimal accretion model is quite complicated as well, because you can't really do it as an n-body calculation. There's just too many of them. If you have to do a statistical calculation of collision rates and buildup of bodies of various sizes, taking into account a lot of big range of particle sizes, bigger ones as well as the smaller ones, and the rate of capture. So there are two parts of this problem. One's the core and one's the envelope. So let's talk a minute about the core. The very basic equation is rate of increase of core mass is just the collision rate times an enhancement factor. So this is the density of solid material. And this is the relative velocity. So you've got a core formed, and you're accreting small bodies onto it. This is the relative velocity of the core and the planetesimals around it. This is the cross-section, the geometrical cross-section of the core itself. This is the core radius. And so you just have a collision rate times a mass per particle there. And then this is the so-called gravitational enhancement factor, the extra cross-section you get.
This is the core radius instead of the total planet radius?
This is, well, we're talking about a core and at the stage where there's not much gas around it anyway. Well, that's a good point. Now, you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, were the density of available particles considered constant in time, or would they have to worry about depletion?
Oh, you have to worry about depletion. Obviously, clearly, you have to worry about depletion, because the planet's going to eat up those particles, and eventually you get to the point where it's eaten up all the particles it can reach gravitationally by collisional effects. And once it's got to that point, it stops accreting, and that's what you call the isolation mass. There's a point about this, though, the capture radius. It doesn't have to be the bare core radius. Once you get some gas collected around the core, then particles plowing through the gas's envelope can be slowed down by gas drag and ablation, and can basically be captured even though they wouldn't actually hit the core. So you get an enhancement, and it turns out to be some significant of RC, it's really the capture cross-section, by the fact that the gas is there. So you have a couple of Earth masses of gas, and especially the smaller particles around, say kilometer size, are just going to be trapped in the envelope, and they're going to fall in. So this could be up to 5 or 10 core radii. Yes?
So is it clear that the density of cores is so low that you can ignore just collisions between different cores as a way of increasing the mass?
The cores themselves?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out in numerical simulation, it seems to work out so you have cores forming at sort of discrete distances away from the star. Each cell in radius away from the star, you have a winner with a largest size particle, which tends to collect most of the other particles in the vicinity. And then about 10 Hilsphere radii away, that is 10 tidal radii away, we have another core that's forming, collecting all the material in its vicinity. And this process tends to work its way outwards from the center of the disk out toward the outer parts of the disk. The time's going to be shorter in the inner parts. So there are several forming at the same time, yes. Or in the time sequence, at least. Several of these. Okay, so you can see basically this is the gravitational enhancement effect. That's what you really have to calculate in detail. And well, you can see that the one's usually unimportant, and so it's 1 over v. It's the important thing. 1 over v, that's the relative velocities of planetesimals and core. And if that's small, it's be quite small, then the m core by dt is large. You can build up your planet fast. And that would be nice, but it turns out that doesn't turn out to be the case. When you have fairly small particles, say a few kilometers in size, the relative velocities are small, and you can build up fairly quickly. But once a few of these relatively large cores are formed, they tend to stir up the velocities of the planetesimals around them, and increase them to higher velocities, and so the accretion rate tends to go down. The problem, as I said, there's a lot of calculation that goes into this, but there have been studies by Martin Duncan has been working on this, for example, Thomas Duncan and Levison, as well as Weidenschilling, as well as Kokuba and Ida, as well as Inaba, Wetherill, and Ikoma. Several different teams have done independent calculations on this and how you get m cores a function of time, and the conclusion is, in order to get even, say, a Jupiter mass at 5 AU, a few Earth masses, 5 AU is what you need. The density of solid particles in a disk has to be something like 5 to 8 times larger than in the so-called minimum mass disk. the minimum mass disk is simply the disk you would need to form the planets, total amount of mass you would need the disk to form the planets as they are now with no extra material left over, 100% efficiency. These calculations show you need 5, maybe 10 times that minimum density in order to form Jupiter at 5 AU. And to form Saturn at 10 AU is maybe even a little bit harder. Not showing any pictures, I'll just state that that's the result of different approaches to the problem, but the conclusion seems to be pretty much the same. And if the disk is going to be that massive, it's, in other words, you need a fairly massive disk to get the formation process to go. It seems to be more massive than the typical observed disk. Typical observed disks are more like the minimum mass. So that's the core problem. Even if you take into account the enhancement of RC because of the gas, because of the presence of the gas. So it looks like you need, say, in order to form Jupiter's core in 4 million years, still getting to be on the long side, need this quite high density disk. Okay, now let's go to the second part of the problem, envelope. So if you've got the core, you still have to collect the core, say 10 to 15 Earth masses, which is what you need. Now you've got to collect all the rest of Jupiter, 300 Earth masses in gas, all right? Why can't you start off with a small core mass and get this rapid gas accretion? Why do you need to get up to 10 to 15 Earth masses to get the thing to go? In fact, it turns out you do. Well, outer radius of the planet when it has a gaseous envelope. Just think of a spherical envelope around the core. The outer radius of that planet is essentially defined by g times the mass of the planet divided by c squared, and c is the sound speed in the disk. So this defines a radius outside of which material is not gravitationally bound to the planet. All material inside RP is gravitationally bound to the planet. So that's the idea. Now suppose the gaseous envelope is relatively small still. You're still at the beginning of the gas accretion phase, then MP is the core mass. And the gas is very small. And so RP doesn't change. RP changes very slowly as you begin to accrete the gas. So this is sort of a fixed number. But how do you get the gas to accrete? You've got to make room for it to get inside this radius. So it's got to contract. The envelope has to contract within RP, and then you can pull in some more gas into RP, and that determines what m dot of the gas is. Okay, so contraction time of that envelope is what's important now. And that time is approximately g times the mass of the envelope times the mass of the core over RL. L is the luminosity radiated by the planet. Okay, so if the luminosity is very low, then you get a very long contraction time. That can be more than the age of the universe if you make the devil small enough. So what happens is, if the core is small, say you have a 3 Earth mass core, then the luminosity radiated, if you do this structure calculation, including the energy generation and the energy transport and so forth, turns out that the luminosity goes to something like the fourth power of the core mass. It's very sensitive to the core mass. So if the core mass is small, then the luminosity is very low, and the contraction time is long. If the core mass is, say, 3 Earth masses, you've got that far, and you put in the numbers, taking this into account, you get this time much longer than the 3 million years. if you have a core mass of 10 Earth masses, and taking into account this effect, contraction time goes down to a couple of million years. So it seems as though there's a critical mass, the order of 10 Earth masses, you need in order to get the envelope to, even once you got the core, to get the envelope to accrete. Yes?
It's mostly atomic line radiation, or it's blackbody radiation?
Well,
what's the source of the
mass radiation? Because you can think of it as blackbody radiation. Yeah, I mean, you have something close to a thermal equilibrium. You've got planetesimals coming in through the gaseous envelope, hitting the core, releasing energy, heating up the interior. And if there aren't any planetesimals accreting, you have the envelope contracting and heating up. And so then you have the temperature gradient, and you're going to have radiative or convective energy transport outwards. And so at the surface, you're going to have something like black body radiation, yes, at the disk temperature. Okay, however, as I just mentioned, the fact that there are planetesimals may still be coming in. If they're still coming in, they fall into close to the core, release the gravitational energy, and provide some of the luminosity, which is eventually radiated outwards, which means it doesn't have to contract as fast as it would otherwise have to, and that will again slow down the contraction time. So this is a lower limit, actually, on the contraction time. It could even be longer because of the planetesimals coming in. So that's the reason the gaseous envelope accretion time is also a problem. How do you get around it? One way is to obviously increase L. L can be increased, say, if you reduce the radiative opacity in the interior of the envelope of the planet, which controls the rate at which the energy flows outwards. So if that opacity is reduced, then L will go up, and it'll contract faster. And that's actually plausible. The timescale estimates are often made based on the opacity of these dust, the small dust particles, which obstruct the flow of radiation. And the properties of dust particles are usually taken to be interstellar dust particles, about which there's some observational information. And it turns out that once those dust particles land in the interior of the planet, they can settle, they can coagulate, they can get down to high enough temperatures so they evaporate. And so the opacity actually would be less than that of the interstellar dust. And some of our recent calculations have shown that you can reduce the formation time by a factor of 3 or so just by this effect alone. And that's one way. The second way would be to cut off the supply of planetesimals falling in through the gaseous envelope, which tend to slow down this time. And that may not be a bad assumption, because once you get up to the point where you're starting to accrete gas in the first place, you probably have a neighboring core 10 tidal radii away, which is collecting its own planetesimals. And the regions will eventually overlap, and so the core you're in question will essentially have very few planetesimals left that can be accreted onto it. So those two effects together can help you and give you a shorter gas formation time. Okay. Now the question is, how can you get up to this 10 Earth masses? This seems to be more or less what you need to form the planet. Well, the important thing in this respect is the so-called isolation mass, the maximum amount of mass that the given core can collect. It's the maximum amount of mass within its gravitational reach, so to speak. Now we're talking about the core. This is the core. Forget about the envelope for the moment. And that is the constant times sigma to the 3/2 and a cubed. Sigma is the surface density of solids in the disk. And a is the semi-major axis. And if you work this out, at, say, in the inner part of the solar system where the Earth is formed, You, at 1 AU, this turns out to be only a fraction of an Earth mass. If you work your way out to Jupiter at 5 AU and enhance the disk to 5 or 10 times its minimum density, this function increases with distance. Sigma goes as a to the minus 3 halves or a to the minus 1. So this function increases with distance until it's not until you get out to, say, 5 AU. That this gets up to 10 Earth masses. So that's one of the main reasons why the model is not going to make the planets of, it's not going to make Jupiter's at 1 AU. Okay, now this is where the, so let me, let's roughly show you what, but the history of your planet is. Here's the mass. And as a function of time, and say this is about, oops. In millions of years, here's what happens with a core. Since say you're at 5 AU in a sufficiently massive disk, core mass comes up rapidly and levels off. Say it's your ideal value of 10 Earth masses. So this is the core. After that, it's fairly constant. And at the beginning, there's hardly any gas, so the gas comes up very slowly. So this is the gas. And that's the crossover point where the rapid gas accretion begins. And this point is the isolation, where the core mass levels off, because there's nothing left for it to accrete. So that's sort of the general picture. Now, what about, why do we predict a metallicity correlation? Okay, first of all, in the formula for the m dot for the core, density of solid particles comes in. So that in itself gets you a higher m dot for the core as these solids, as you increase the metallicity, this increases the solid surface density. Also, the isolation mass goes sigma to the 3 halves. This is the solid surface density. So as the isolation mass increase the metallicity, increase the solid surface density, increase the isolation mass. If you increase the isolation mass, then the luminosity radiated goes up as a fourth power. And the contraction time gets shorter and shorter. So that says the formation time for a star, formation time for a star with high metallicity is shorter than that for one with lower metallicity. But how does that translate into percentages? It's not quite the same, not quite the same thing. Percentages. Okay, well, there's an argument that goes something like this. So I'm going to stop in about 5 minutes. Is that okay? Okay. Suppose you have, just consider the family of all possible disks. It's characterized by a mass and an angular momentum, J. So a disk with small mass and high angular momentum would be very spread out, very large, low density. So there's going to be some region in here forbidden for forming planets because the surface density of the disk never gets high enough to give you the critical 10 Earth masses in a reasonable amount of time. So there'll be the low mass, high angular momentum disks just have too low a density to form planets. Another forbidden region over here, where the disk has low angular momentum and relatively high mass, so it's compact and dense. In that case, the small particles, say centimeter size, meter size, are going to migrate inwards because of interaction with the disk. The so-called gas drag effect will cause those small particles to migrate inwards and reach the point of evaporation before they have a chance to build up planets. All the solid material will simply end up in the star. So that cuts out another region of the space. What's left in between, luckily, according to one particular model, at least, there is an allowed region in between where you can form planets, say, in 3 million years, in a reasonable amount of time. However, if you reduce the metallicity, the solid surface density tends to go down. And that simply means that this allowed region is going to get smaller and smaller as you reduce the metallicity. And eventually, once you get to some critical metallicity, that allowed region is going to disappear. No planets at all. And that may occur at around 10th solar metallicity. That, of course, still has to be checked with observations. So that's how the model does predict
Did you cherry pick your mechanisms?
What? Sorry?
You forgot about migration of bigger things, didn't you? I'm asking if you cherry picked
The model I just showed here assumed there wasn't any migration. And as I mentioned at the beginning, that's still a problem. I was just trying to simplify things as much as possible. So if
based on sigma and on migration of small bodies by gas brack, you get these regions. But what if you include a wider range of physical processes? Wouldn't you get these things differently?
This depends on migration of small particles, but it doesn't include migration of the planets themselves once they're building up.
That still
has to be
wouldn't
included.
That allowed region disappear?
The present theory of so-called type 1 migration, which occurs when the planet is 1 to 10 Earth masses, would say that all the planets migrate into the star on a time scale short compared to the formation time. So there'd be no allowed region.
Right.
So, I mean, that's what the theorists have to come up with an answer to that.
Why only gas drag on small particles and only overall surface density should be important, if that's true?
Well, there's an implicit assumption is that somehow in the future the type 1 migration problem is going to be solved, or at least for some of the planets. So I think that's one of the problems that people are working on right here. Okay, so but it's clearly as you reduce the metallicity, that region is going to get smaller. I'm just trying to explain the metallicity effect. Final point is what observations are going to shed some light on all this. I'm just going to mention a few. There are lots of possibilities. I'm just going to mention a few. Some of these I've already touched on. Transits of planets across the star allow the measurement of the radius of the planet. So far, there are a couple of cases that have been reported. If you have a planet in the 0.1 AU range away from the star, fairly close to the star, and it's a fairly low-mass planet, say a few tenths of a Jupiter mass, it turns out from some models at least that the radius is quite different and measurably different if the planet has a solid core or if it doesn't. So if such planets turn out to have relatively small radii indicating the presence of core, that would favor the core accretion process. Second possibility, look at young stars. Very youngest stars. In order to measure and determine whether or not they have planets, you have to do it by astrometry, measure the offset of the position of the star as a consequence of the orbiting planet around it. And that may eventually be done from space with a spacecraft called SIM, just due to go up in 5 years or so. So if the very youngest stars have planets, that's an argument against the core accretion process because it takes a few million years to form the planets by this process, which implies maybe the gravitational instability process was in operation. Now, the third point was the metallicity. And this correlation already pretty well shows. And the observation that I showed at the beginning and the theory, approximate as it is, definitely favors the core accretion process. Because the gravitational stability mechanism doesn't depend on metallicity at all, apparently. And, okay, the fourth point is the giant planets in the solar system, which I've also mentioned. Their core masses and the fact that their envelopes are enhanced in heavy elements relative to the sun does favor the core accretion. And the final point is, suppose you were able to observe giant planet, Jupiter-type planet, at 50 AU from the star. People are looking for such things right now. The core accretion process says you can't make a planet 50 AU. The m-dot times for the core accretion simply get longer and longer and longer. It's even not possible to make Uranus and Neptune, the present distances, according to the present models of the core accretion. So a planet of 50 AU just isn't going to be formed by this process. And so if there turns out to be one, and that's, of course, in the range, it's far enough away from the star so that one possibly could observationally detect one out there. That would imply some other process must be going on, such as gravitational instability. Okay, so the conclusion is at the moment that the core accretion process is favored, but there are a lot of problems, especially the three problems I wrote down at the beginning. Thank you.
So do I have it right? The first problem, the timing problem, you have no answer to except maybe gravitational instability vortices.
The timing problem turns out the core can be accreted in 4 million. The core can be built in 4 million years at 5 AU if you have this enhanced density in the disk.
But you said that contradicts observation.
If you look at the young stars now that have this, they seem to have this masses less than that. It's possible that at an earlier stage in the history of the disk, it may have been more massive. Or there may be some mechanism to transfer heavy elements preferentially, say from the outer part of the disk, into the inner parts and enhance the density locally, rather than have the whole disk mass enhanced. The gas accretion problem, I think, with reasonable opacities, and especially if you have used up the available supply of planetesimals around that the planet can accrete, that's only 2 million years or so. So a total of about 6 million years with the high mass disk. So it's marginally possible.
And you mentioned vortices very briefly.
Okay, I didn't have time to get to that. Maybe it's somebody else during this session that's going to go into that in more detail. I didn't have time to go into that. But a vortex can concentrate the small particles. Actually, it can eat up the small particles and they give you a higher, very local surface density. They give you possibly give you much faster core formation time, DMDT, for the core.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Is there any notion that some of this accretion process could go on during the process of the star formation itself? In the early stages, before the star is fully formed?
In the early stages of star formation, well, what you have is the beginning of the star in the center of the configuration, and you've got a disk around it that's feeding it.
Yeah.
And you have the infalling cloud, gravitational collapsing cloud falling up, most of its material is actually falling onto the disk. So at that point, you can, the disk is probably fairly active, fairly unstable. It's transferring material pretty rapidly onto the star. So you have the problem of, even if you make a planet, it's probably going to be swept into the star after it's formed. Although the process of grain coagulation building up in larger sizes, that can start. The problem is, will a lot of those grains end up in the star also? So it's...
But it might help.
And the time scale is about, the formation time is, okay, it's, okay, a few times, half a million years maybe. So help a little bit.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Well,